All right, everyone, welcome to the latest episode of Liberty Lens. I am your host, Big John, joined as always by the ever-impressive, coming off a major victory on the Are You Smarter Than a Politician internet game show, my favorite internet game show, none other than Mr. Mike Termott. Mike, how are you doing today?
It's good to be with you. No, I'm not smarter than a politician, and that's not just because I have been a politician, but I think I was sandbagged. I think they let me win.
That's okay. We'll take it. It's a W. And as I like to crow, the Grumblings Media team, 3-0 on that show. Victories from Hody, Mike, and I squeaked by with a win, too. So 3-0, that's got to mean something, Mike. What it means, I'm not quite sure.
It means a lot, and that's how I know that they let us win, because the only way you two guys could have won is if they let you. So I know they let me win, too. I think they're just letting all of us win. I think it means that Free wants to be on one of your shows. That's the only explanation.
Yeah, the fact that we let him on, though, had nothing to do with the judging. I'm pretty sure about that, but wink. No backroom deals here. We're libertarians, after all. Anyway,
no, it was up front. I think you just slipped him like $100.
That's cool. Capitalism works. All right, this is Liberty Lent right here on Grumblings Media, grumblingsmedia.com. Check out all our fine shows. You could go to grumblingsmedia.com, go to YouTube, Rumble, Facebook, or X under the Grumblings Media handle. You'll find us there, as well as all the podcasting platforms you could think of, Amazon, Spotify, Pandora, and Apple podcast. So basically anywhere you care to listen to us, you'll probably find us there. Mike, for today's episode, the first thing I want to talk about, actually the only thing probably we could talk about, is President Trump's address to the United Nations. Now, this one I think may have libertarians, for the most part, tied up a little bit in knots, because I remember growing up, one of the first things I learned hanging around with the libertarian crowd was to be able to say very loudly, get us out of the UN. And
yes,
living in New York, I can attest to let's get rid of them, because the traffic jams in Manhattan around that horrible building can be deadly. It makes every New Yorker's life horrible, especially when there's foreign dignitaries.
It is rough. I used to live just a few blocks from there. It's rough.
There you go. It is rough. But that aside, President Trump did address the United Nations General Assembly the other day. And I want to go over what was said there, your reactions to that. How
sure.
Libertarians and people of liberty should, and even Republicans of the Republican Liberty Caucus, should perhaps take a look at what the president had to say. So first of all, let's set the stage. President Trump was allotted 15 minutes to make a speech. His speech ran 56 minutes long.
Which is more. Technically speaking, that's more.
That's more. And
In fairness, you only give me a half an hour and we prattle on for 56 minutes all the time, too.
I was about to say, maybe we should make him an offer to join the show, because we're always over time anyway, right? But Mike, so in this speech, the president had like a very clear agenda, and I'll give him credit. The loss of a teleprompter, which we'll talk about later mid-speech, didn't seem to faze him. He just barreled on at times with some charm, but at other times with statements that, from the reactions, were received very coolly, to say the least. There wasn't a thunderous round of applause. There weren't boos. It was almost like stone silence for the most part.
Yeah.
But let's get to it. One of the things he talked about, like he touched on immigration, right?
Yep.
And he said, like, hey, look what we're doing in the U.S., and I think all you guys around the world need to do the same thing. Control your borders, stymie immigration, or else you guys are cooked. I'm paraphrasing, of course.
Yep.
And a lot of people took this to be along partisan lines, right? Like, for the nationalist-leaning countries around the world, this was received. This was one of the few times where you heard, like, a smattering of applause in the assembly. And then, of course, if you're a country not prone to nationalism, you viewed this as, what's he trying to do? Which I think, say, Macron mentioned something like that following
right.
Trump's comments. Mike, what do you think of this, that basically the president went to the UN, in this instance, to scold them on their immigration policies?
He did. He scolded them on any number of things that we should probably touch on.
We'll get to them.
And we will get to – I'll follow your lead. We'll get to them. I think a lot of those things the UN earned. I think a lot of that criticism the UN has earned over the years, and we'll get to that. Regarding immigration, I continue to believe that the Trump administration, that the president fundamentally understands correctly what it is that the American public was looking for from his administration, why people voted for him. Something like north of 80% of the American population wanted control over the border, wanted a rationalized immigration policy, wants to live in a nation of laws, meaning if you're here illegally, you got to go. I think most people recognize that to make someone leave the United States who doesn't feel like leaving the United States, it's not a pretty process. So I, you know, he's got a very, very strong hand, politically speaking, domestically. And remember, all politics is local, and therefore every speech is domestic. He has to be speaking to an American audience. He's got to be speaking to you and me, which he was,
right?
Even though he's not on foreign soil, but in front of a lot of foreigners making this speech. So he's got a very strong hand. It's just that I continue to believe that he overplays a very strong hand. And I believe he does that in two ways. Number one, the one that drives us crazy as libertarians, is that his administration doesn't do a sufficient job in adhering to due process as required by the Constitution. And we can all debate about how much due process is required in certain instances.
Right.
But his administration seems to say, it's more important that we take care of business than we worry about the Constitution. That drives us crazy. And then the other thing is what came up the other day. And that is when he said at one point, I'll get this wrong, I'm not trying to quote perfectly, but in effect, he said, nations have a right, and it came off as nations have an obligation or a responsibility. But I think he said something like nations have a right to protect their populations. Again, maybe not quite the right word, but
right.
In essence, from overwhelming immigration from people who are not like them, who have different religions, who are different in every way, something
right.
like this. And it came off not merely as nationalistic, which it absolutely was, and I don't
right.
mean that in a flattering way or in a good way.
Right.
But it came off as a little nasty, particularly when he included the word religion. It came off as you need to protect yourself from a whole lot of them, whatever them is.
Right.
You got to protect yourself from them. And the irony, you know, good for you for bringing up Macron, who did speak soon after Trump, because these guys are taking positions that you might have expected would have been opposite.
It's like Freaky Friday. I agree with
it's
you.
Freaky
yeah.
Friday. If you went back 20 years ago and you said the President of the United States is going to speak, and then, you know, the French president's going to speak, and this is what they're going to say, you say, I think you got those two mixed up.
Right.
Because the
right.
French have always been all about the idea that there's nothing better you can be than to be French.
Right.
And they don't mean conceptually French, or I identify as French, or I was born in France. They mean your grandfather's grandfather's grandfather was French.
True, true.
And we don't marry anyone from Spain. We don't even have friends in England. We are French. That's an exaggeration that came off a little nasty, but there is a little bit of that. To loosen that up just a touch, in my family, there's an old saying. I'm not proud of this, but I'm going to share this saying with you, okay? So you understand, I know where this comes from. There's an old saying, if you're not Dutch, you're not much. Now,
right.
you may have heard this expression, and it's funny, it's tee-hee-hee, but the truth of the matter is I've got cousins who wouldn't marry anyone but a Dutchman, right?
Right. And look, there's a lot of nations like that, and it's not specific to Americans, French, Dutch, Greeks, Italians, whoever you care to name. Most monocultural countries have a strain of that. The United States is supposed to be different than that, right?
And just most people in the United States don't realize that the United States is the least racist nation on the planet.
Agreed. At least, yes. But let me also very quickly, since you mentioned it, let me give you the words because I have it on my phone here. You have the right to control your – this is from Trump. You have the right to control your borders as we do now and to limit the sheer numbers of migrants entering their countries and paid for by the people of that nation that were there and that built that particular nation at that time. That's the president's sentence, run-on sentence, not mine. They put their blood, sweat, tears, money into that country, and now they're being ruined. Proud nations must be allowed to protect their communities and prevent their societies from being overwhelmed by people they have never seen before, with different customs, religions, with different everything. Now, Mike, I think, to your point, while I agree with you, Trump got into office on some great level on three things: controlling the borders, releasing the Epstein files, and fixing the economy, right? I would say those were his three major reasons for getting into office. Two of them we know he's failing at miserably.
Yeah, I think that there's a couple more there, but I get your list. I don't have merely quibbles with your list. One, I would add to that list civil liberties and raising a big middle finger to the Democratic Party.
But. Sure. Fair enough. I don't know if those are like policies, but fair enough. I got you. And I think we're basically on the same page. But when you read that quote the way I just read it, I think that sort of undertone of meanness that you mentioned, I think becomes a little clearer, right? Because he's not just saying this is what we did in the United States to take care of the issue we had. He's scolding them that, hey, France, for the sake of argument, since Macron spoke up afterwards, you're destroying your country. And maybe by destroying your country, we're not going to allow that, because here's how I view it. And you're right. The fact that he threw in culture and religion in there as well. Again, what normally would be an anathema to an American politician to say that, like, here in the U.S., we don't believe in that integration. We don't believe in that melting pot anymore. Because that's what I took away from it. And when you combine it with the rhetoric that's coming out of his vice president, Vance, the rhetoric coming out of Stephen Miller, especially, who has taken every opportunity, I think, it's been documented that he pinches stuff from Goebbels' speeches in 1936. And when you look at that thing, I think the nationalism that you just referred to is more apparent and it's more direct. And I have no idea what the president's motivations are, what his, quote, true feelings are, what's really in his heart, as people like to say. But when he does stuff like this, Mike, I find it very hard to think that he has the American tradition in mind, that he has the American ethos in mind.
Well, as a very bad attorney once said to me, we're changing the tradition. Look, I had a business partner once who said to me, this will come as completely no surprise to you. He once said to me, once we've made the sale.
Shut up. Yeah.
Trump has already made the sale to the American people on immigration.
Right.
Right?
Right.
We wanted immigration to be under control, and the border to be under control. We don't like the unconstitutional nature of the Obama administration saying we don't have the power to just disregard federal law and let everyone stay here. Oh, we're going to do it anyway. I think that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way.
Right.
And so Trump won. He not only won that argument, he won the overall debate. He won the election. He won power. He made the sale. Now,
you're right.
And when he says,
good point, by the way, that's a great point. Yeah.
You know, when he starts talking about all this nationalistic bullshit, it makes it seem like, oh, you know, I agreed with him about so much, and now, you know, have I seen this wrong? You know, do I need to feel badly? And I don't want to feel bad. Like, he's undermining his own base. He's undermining his own position. And right. I fear he's undermining the long-term success, ironically, of his own program. Because Americans wanted control over the border, and they wanted the rule of law regarding immigration status, not because we have all of a sudden decided we want to be more like France and less like America. That's not why.
Right.
We don't like socialism, giving away money, cheating, jumping the line, out of control. We didn't like the implications for crime because, notwithstanding the fact that it is true what I have always said, which is immigrants commit crime at lower rates than people who are born here, right. That does not pertain to people who are here illegally. The president is correct about people who come here illegally. They actually commit crime at a higher rate. So that's another reason. He got all these reasons, right, which do not include we don't like Hispanic people, right? That's not a thing because that's not how Americans feel. Americans don't walk around saying, oh, you know, my ancestors are from Switzerland. Let's get rid of the Hispanics in Dade County, Florida. That's not a thing that you hear, right? It's just not. I'm sorry to call it like it is, but that's not how this works. And so if you're trying to sell us on, you know, we need to preserve our traditional ethnic heritage, which is how it came off. He didn't use the word ethnic. He didn't use ethnicity. But when you start, we need protection from unfamiliar religions. Oof. That's not how most Americans feel.
Yeah, I agree with you. And again, I don't know. It's very, I think you've been like a broken record with this point. He is not being served by his staff. Whoever puts these speeches together, excuse me, I'd love to know, was this his actual speech that he planned to give? What was on that broken teleprompter? Or like before, when they were sitting together, whether it was Stephen Miller or some other group of speechwriters, like a TV room, did Trump say, make sure you mention that we don't like other religions or we don't like other cultures and that's what's destroying the world? Is that a directive that came from Trump? Is it a directive that came from Steve Bannon? Is it a directive that came from Stephen Miller? Like, I would love to know, is this what Trump really thinks? Because if it's what he really thinks, I think we're in trouble as a nation. However, if it's what you've always sort of, the way you're framing it, which I have no reason not to believe that your sincerity in your analysis, Mike, which is he saw a problem. He saw unfettered immigration causing these issues. He saw the strain on the Treasury. He saw the strain on local communities, especially the border states and the border towns. And he said, hey, we got to get this under control. And like you and your running mate, when you guys were running for office in 2024, said, hey, maybe we need 1,000 Ellis Islands. Maybe we need to up the legal ways we can get immigrants,
right.
Do basic checks, make sure that the people who are actually criminals, let's process them, get them adjudicated as quickly as possible, and get them the hell out of here.
And it still means you have to have some control over the border. You can't have 1,000 Ellis Islands if it's a billion Ellis. Like if every
right.
square foot is an Ellis Island and you just get to come in whenever you – that's not right. what we're talking about. You have to have some control.
Right, and historically, we've seen that borne out, that when Ellis Island, being where it is in New York, what was the main port of entry for nearly every alien every immigrant that came to this country for the first 200 years of this nation? They all ended up in New York. That's why New York is built the way it is, right?
Yep.
And then they would disperse throughout the country slowly, right, to where there was opportunity, to where there was a welcome.
Right.
So I think that to me is at heart of what the president had to say. Is it what he really thinks, or is he being manipulated by these other actors and not being served properly? And I think that's something all of us should bear in mind as we move forward.
You're right. Probably right. And from the standpoint of the election, I think Americans didn't have to make that distinction.
Right.
You know, the elections are much cruder right. than our post-election analysis.
Agreed. And also, I think most polls now are showing that even those that supported President Trump's immigration stance during the campaign season don't necessarily agree with what's played out on the streets, what's played out in the media, which is these ICE raids and the violence and all that. So I think, we're coming to an inflection.
Yeah, the campaign team did a much better job of convincing us there was going to be prioritization. We're going after the criminals first, right? There was none of this protect you from unfamiliar religions type of talk.
Right.
So if he would stay on that message, I think he would do a better job of avoiding undermining his long-term success.
I agree with you on that. Okay, one of the other things that the president touched on his address that, as we noted, went over by about 40 minutes, climate change skepticism. He called it a farce, a scam. Basically, the whole world's been hoodwinked, Mike. Talk to me about that. How do you think that went over, his comments of climate change being a scam?
Well, certainly there's a bifurcation. There are still a lot of people that believe that there's a scam element to it. By the way, there is a scam element to it. That's not really an interesting statement in the sense that there's a scam element to almost everything in the world these days, right? So let me see if I can say something less disinteresting than that. It is true that there are politicians who want to take advantage of any disaster.
Right.
And climate change is another one of those. And we do need to guard ourselves against what are, in effect, socialists who want to hijack the American federal government and other governments, by the way. That's a whole nother podcast. In order to direct our economy in ways that would serve those particular interests of those politicians and use as a vehicle to do so fear that comes from climate change. All that is real.
Right.
But that doesn't mean that weather-related phenomena and changes in those over long periods of time are a hoax. Again, the president has a strong hand here. He has a strong hand here in the sense that we all know, and a lot of people in that room at the UN know it too, and they won't like to admit it, but they know it, that capitalism works better than socialism.
Yeah.
And so if you've got the world's strongest economy, strongest for 100 years, by the way, the world's strongest, most innovative, healthiest economy with the best long-term prospects, not only because of how it works, but because you're going to deregulate and because we're the most innovative and tech-forward economy in the world. If you have all that at your disposal, you don't have to oversell. You can say, look, whether you believe that climate change is coming like a freight train or whether you believe it's coming like a puppy, you do not want socialists in your government, in your economy, in your businesses, in your population, hijacking your governments and using your governmental apparatuses in order to make decisions that are not in your long-term interest. And just like every politician who would use any disaster as an excuse to gain power, you need to make sure that climate change is not such a vehicle.
Right.
And furthermore, if you really are the kind of person who believes the world is going to hell in a handcart,
right,
do you want the redistribution of trillions of dollars of assets in order to prepare yourself for this freight train coming? Do you want that to be driven by decisions made by socialistic politicians or by deregulated businesses?
I agree with you. Like, obviously, as libertarians, but just in general, if you pay attention to history, you're absolutely right. It's been capitalism that's propelled society forward and also, for the most part, provided the innovation to help us meet challenges head on. But I think that message, Mike, again, would have been better received than this is a scam. Go fossil fuels, go nuke. And, you guys got to get with it. This is a scam. I think, to your point, it's not just climate change that suffers from the potential of government ownership, regulation, and deployment, right, of resources. That could apply to anything. And I don't mean to be generalized or a both sides argument, but it's just true. It's like the government is the least efficient model for producing anything. The only thing it's good at is war. That is it.
Yep.
Other than that, it's always been.
And that's only because no one else wants to do it. It's the government that wants to convince you to go to war. No one else wants a piece of that action.
Right, exactly. So I agree with you on that. And while I do think, you know, just to sort of tag on to what you said, I do think there is man-made climate change. And yep. I also think part of it is due to the natural progression of the Earth. It's a cycle. Yep. We all understand that. But at the same time, who can understand better the opportunity costs and the urgencies other than the actual marketplace, as opposed to the government that has ancillary and secondary considerations, like will I get elected next week? Will I next cycle? Yep. You know, and things like that. So to that point, I'll give Trump half credit at most, saying that he had the right idea.
Yeah, again, I think he's got a strong hand, and I think he overplayed it. Yeah. And, you know, by the way, when selling an idea, it typically doesn't work out as well when you start out with, all you people are stupid.
Yeah.
Let me explain why.
Yeah.
Because as it turns out, I'm the only guy who's right about everything.
Yeah, well, you know, J.D. Vance said so. What do you say? We've had nothing but dumb presidents until this one was, I think, the vice president's quote. All right, let's move on. Another part of the president's address there to the General Assembly was, in fact, a critique of the United Nations itself. So, again, to your point, perhaps starting out this segment with, trust me before I say this, you guys are all stupid. Let me explain what's going on, right? Like, I think that falls into that bucket as well. Basically, and again, I'm not here to tell you that I necessarily disagree with the president's sentiment on this, which was he accused the UN of, quote, empty words. He said he's cutting back contributions, even though the U.S., I mean, it's a fact, the U.S. is the biggest contributor to the U.N. in terms of 22% of its budget. We house them permanently, basically as a foreign embassy in New York. They have some prime real estate in New York. and he said basically we're quitting all their councils and stuff. Mike, I know, again, like I said, this has long been a libertarian and, to be fair, a traditional conservative stance. You know, like, say, a Barry Goldwater stance would have been, get us out of the UN. We have no business allowing the UN to in any way infringe on our sovereignty. I tend to agree with that. But tell me, did you feel that the president's approach was correct? And potentially, let me throw this monkey wrench at you. How does it affect our standing with the world if we're basically telling them we've already cut U.S. aid for whatever portion of that budget would have reached foreign governments for humanitarian purposes, and that going forward we plan on cutting back our contributions to this wretched body?
Yeah, I hear you. Again, this goes in the category of strong hand overplayed, missold.
Yeah.
So many people in the United States, and by the way, not merely in the United States, a lot of people around the world believe that the United Nations is a pain in the neck and it's not worth it.
Right.
This has to be sold not in the context of, I hate multilateral institutions, they compromise sovereignty, and by the way, this is the dopiest on the planet, we should, you know, stick a fork in it. No. None of which is wrong, but if I were selling it, I would do so in the context of shared objectives. We all want a world in which we're getting rich because we do a good job of allowing our economic entities to work together.
Right.
And a part of that is keeping the peace and creating a world in which we're not at war so that we can all engage in trade. We can stop spending so much money on defense, and we can all get rich. That's the object of the game. Okay. Given that, we do believe in diplomacy. And I really liked it, by the way, when Trump said the UN is not living up to its potential. right? The people who go to the UN frequently talk about the UN being so valuable because of the conversations that you can have there that are difficult to have anywhere else. And that's for a couple different reasons. One is that everyone's there at the same time.
Right.
So if you want something that's going to be a bilateral conversation, trilateral, quadrilateral, you can do that in a much more flexible and rapidly evolving way over a couple of, you know, 2-3 day period. The other reason is because you don't have to make a big deal out of the imagery of a summit. When two leaders get together, all the planning goes into it because of expectations and symbolism, all the crap that makes it very difficult. At the end of the day, more often than not, nations just decide, hey, it's not worth it. We're going to accidentally send the wrong signal. We'll call you on the phone instead. Whereas at the UN, if everyone's expected to be there, just, you know, bumping into each other in the hallway and then crawling off for a meeting, even if it's planned, looks much less like something of which you should have a high expectation. And therefore, the informalness makes it easier to actually pull off. Okay. Given that there really is value in shoving all these people into the same building a couple of times a year, given that, we could do that without all of this superstructure apparatus and people voting, right, and coming to resolutions, because that's what Trump is referring to when talking about, you know, sternly worded letter that's not backed up by anything. Well, in some cases, the fact that it's not backed up is a good thing, because some of these letters are silly.
Right.
They don't reflect America's interest. Say what you will about what's going on today about Gaza and Israel and everyone's mad at each other. I'm not even talking about that. I just mean over the past 25 years, there have been resolutions one after another that are not in America's interest. Why are we allowing this group of people to come to New York and taking a vote about how much they think we're stupid? That is not something... You know, if we wanted to call ourselves stupid, we could take an ad in the New York Times and say we're stupid. We don't need to be paying all this money for these people to come and do it.
Right.
I would suggest a reform proposal. Talk about our shared values, our shared objectives.
Right.
Talk about the fact that there is really valuable stuff here in this organization, but we're not putting up with this silliness anymore. If you sell us on that, I think you bring a lot of people together in a way that you don't when you say, you people are stupid and I'm sick of it.
I agree with you. And I mean, it's an interesting point you brought up. I never really thought about it that way. But the concept of a permanent diplomacy hall, like an international diplomacy hall that guarantees neutrality, say, where these diplomats can't go stay for a week or two without any pomp and circumstance. And like you said, literally perhaps have a cup of coffee with people they're trying to get deals done with or come to agreements on, might actually be a better use of that real estate than what it's doing now.
Yeah.
Where, like, I mean, if I was not on the Security Council, why would I care about the UN at all?
Because right.
Anything I bring to the table is easily overridden by either the United States, Russia, China, whatever, right? So it's really their interests that are aligning, not any member states.
That's a really good point. And the other thing you find is that a lot of the diplomacy that takes place, a lot of the back and forth, a lot of the lobbying that takes place in the UN is regarding not what's actually in their interests, regarding what's happening in the world of reality, but it's about UN resolutions themselves. It's, you know, will you be on this resolution with me? Will you veto that resolution? Will you vote for this resolution? None of which reflects reality.
Right.
That's just internal UN crap, right? Stop wasting my time with a conversation about whether or not I'm going to be behind you on a UN resolution. Why don't we talk about war?
Yeah.
Why don't we talk about peace? Why don't we talk about trade? Why don't we talk about economics? Why don't we talk about investment?
Yeah, like I literally view it, Mike, as, and this is so childish of me because it's so simple in my head, but why, like if the UN served as a place where, say, the Prime Minister of Israel and the Supreme Leader of Iran bump into each other in a room, they start to talking, and if they have any disagreements, you go, hey, you know who we both trust? Let me get that guy from Nigeria. He seems to have a good head on his shoulders. Maybe we'll use him as an informal
mediator. The big guy that's going to make us stop punching each other in the face.
Exactly, right? And, I mean, I know it's a cartoonish way of looking at it, but that's one of the things I had in mind, that if potentially that's what the UN could be. Just like we all agree, nobody gets shot at this place. There's no armed guards there other than for in-and-out security, and let's go there. The second thing that I will hear my liberal friends chirp about when I tell them that we should get out of the UN is, but what about all those committees they have, like the World Health Organization, what was it, UNICEF, like all these things that run these international charities, these international distribution networks. And I mean, look, when you and I were kids, what was the one thing you always heard about UNICEF or WHO or whatever? They're immunizing poor countries. The people, the measles rates are dropping, diphtheria,
absolutely,
and things like that, right? Now, are we?
Well, we're all getting hit by cars at the intersection, passing out the boxes, trying to get dimes, right?
Right, right. So, touch on that for me. Like, is that age gone in your mind because of polarization? Where, like, or is it just that we don't even trust? We've gotten to the point where we don't trust anything in terms of the government doing it. There was a time when we said, yeah, MMR vaccines are good, and they're distributing it to the poor people of the world to prevent children from dying. And whether we were naive or not, Mike, I happen to think we were right. But is that a valid reason?
Well, all those things can be true at once. You know, right. You can be right and be naive. You can be manipulated by very dark forces who, you know, every couple of years get one right.
Yeah.
You know, John Gotti may have hated the Yankees and the Mets as much as I did. That didn't make him a good guy.
Right.
Look, in my view, those sub-organizations should go. I think that they were probably a bad idea in the beginning, but I think that whatever value there was in them is gone. And that's not because charitable organizations don't have a role to play.
Right.
I just don't think that there's a good reason for them to be attached to the United Nations.
Okay.
As a matter of fact, you could probably spin them off altogether. You could either spin them off one at a time. You could spin them off altogether. Be as creative as you want. You can auction them off.
I was going to say, in essence, you're saying you could privatize them.
You know, Bill Gates can take one, and Bill Clinton can take one, and Warren Buffett can take one, and John Gotti can take one, and you know, it's gonna be fine. I just don't think that it needs to be attached to an organization that's populated by a bunch of people who go on vacation once a year to say bad things about the United States in Manhattan.
Right. No, I agree with you, and I just wanted to get your opinion on that because I could hear people saying, well, what about the humanitarian efforts of the UN? And to your point, you don't need binding resolutions for that. You don't need to have member states for that. You know, maybe you go around, ask for contributions or whatever.
Plenty of people do these sorts of things out of brownstones in Alexandria. You don't need the United Nations.
Yeah, and you look at things like the like Doctors Without Borders or something to that effect, you know, that are privately run, unless there's something about Doctors Without Borders that I'm unaware of, some scandal that I'm unaware of. But,
well, I'm sure there will be at some point, but as far as we know, let me be naive about this. They seem like a good group. I know
like a decent outfit, right?
They've been mad at the Israeli government lately, but so have I. That doesn't make us correct, right? There are organizations out there that do a good job. But, you know, to your point, if there is going to be a scandal,
right.
And, you know, organizations go through scandals sometimes, irrespective of how wonderful the people were that started them.
Yes, because at some point they grow out of their control, just like any.
Absolutely. And it only takes one dingleberry to do something really stupid and bring down someone's reputation. Okay. If that's something that can happen in the real world, do you want that attached to the United Nations? Or. do you want all of these organizations to be in some sense competitive in the milieu of a broad range of organizations that provide charitable services?
You're right. You're right. I and thank you. Sometimes I ask these questions so I could have you give a much more polished answer than what I would provide. So thank you for that, Mike. Okay, let's wrap this up. One of the things that the UN that is now percolating more since it happened is the and I'll use air quotes just to be professional, the malfunctions that occurred specifically to President Trump when he was at the UN. I'm talking about two incidents, one which is half comical and the other one which could have been potentially serious. The first one is, as we noted earlier, his teleprompter stopped working in the middle of his speech. Yep. Now, as we said, he handled it. Even for someone who dislikes Trump like myself, he handled it very well. He made a little joke about it. He moved on. He seemed to know his speech enough where it didn't seem like he stumbled or anything like that.
I thought it was pretty impressive.
It was. I agree, especially for an 80-year-old man who's on the run constantly. It was very impressive. So that was one malfunction. But the one that I think was potentially dangerous, without assigning any necessarily intent or anything like that, but just factually, was when he went to step on the elevator with the First Lady, the elevator came to a halt. The escalator came to a halt. Now, two things impressed me about that. One, is that really just a malfunction or was that a prank or something deliberate? It's natural. I'll go with the administration on this one. It's natural to ask that. The second thing is that's literally a kill zone. That is like somewhere that if you did want to have, if you had someone who had bad intention towards the president, that's how you get him to stop moving. That's how you get his detail to stop moving. And he becomes a sitting duck. So I think there was a security concern at that.
It's what we call a fatal funnel.
Fatal funnel, right. That's the term I had in mind. And surprisingly to me, there wasn't an instantaneous circling of him by the Secret Service. Nobody drew their weapons. Now, I don't know if that was the better part of discretion. I didn't know if they realized that was going to happen. But, Mike, talk to me a little bit about that. Being a former cop, being involved in government, describe, A, the malfunctions in general, and, B, specifically the security concern with the escalator.
With the escalator, I was shocked that the Secret Service was not immediately surrounding him. That is the same thing as if your car comes to a grinding halt, right?
Right.
If the beast blows the gasket and comes to a screeching halt, there better be a protocol in place other than the Donald and Melania just walk it.
Right.
Right. By the way, I was impressed that the Donald immediately started walking up the steps. You know, good for him. Speaking of 80-year-old man. And by the way, I think he was wearing a new suit that was cut a little bit differently, but I think it's because he's gained a little bit of weight. Mr. President, lay off the carbs and hit the treadmill a little bit. So I was impressed that he had no problem not only climbing the steps, but deciding to do, not much hesitation there. Good for him. Secret Service should have been on top of that for the reasons that you explained immediately. We did not have a view of the top of the escalator at the moment.
Right.
Well, they may have felt like they had total control, but it does bring up, is there anyone in the periphery who appreciated a standing target rather than a moving one? I do believe it very unlikely that this was anything but an innocent screw up. That's not the point.
Correct.
If there's a 1% chance that this was done on purpose, and of that 1%, a 1% chance that it was done on purpose because somebody wanted to kill him. Okay, that's 1 in 10,000. That's a lot when the president is in 10,000 weird situations over the course of 4 years, right? That means at some point you're going to run into something like this. You know, we just concluded a trial of a crazy guy who wanted to shoot the president while playing golf.
Right.
And had himself positioned so that when he slowed down on the putting green,
right,
we're all familiar with Dealey Plaza, where you make the turn, you slow down, And then he's going away from you from the bookstore, so you've got that shot that's not as hard to make. These things are real. Assassins take these things into consideration, and that's why the Secret Service does. So, yes, the right thing to do is an investigation. But absolutely, to your point, I'll use your quotes, an investigation. I don't think you want to be in public saying, we're pissed, we're going to have an investigation. And if you are going to say that, you don't want it to be the press secretary who says this. It came off as really partisan and slightly paranoid, even though I don't think it was partisan or paranoid. It comes off that way when you have a very partisan member of your administration with no security responsibility or understanding making the comment. What you want to do is have the president play it off, as he did, you know, and he can complain. By the way, we do need to touch on that. Let me just go off to the side for sure. 1 second. When the president used the stupid escalator mishap and the stupid teleprompter mishap as metaphors for the UN not working well, I thought that was very skillfully done.
Very clever, absolutely.
Very clever. And he's not wrong. He exaggerates woefully and wholly his role in stopping these wars.
Seven wars, yeah.
The seven wars around the world. He exaggerates. But as you and I have discussed in the past, I'm okay with a guy who's motivated to stop war so that he can exaggerate his roles, right? That's the least of our problems, is who gets credit. You know, I'm okay with that. If it's true, I have no reason to believe it's not. If it's true that the United Nations really did not step up to the plate while the White House, while the administration, while the president is working hard on these things, I'll give you it's an exaggeration. But if they're engaged, the United Nations is not, you know, come on. You at least got to make the phone call. If you're the general secretary, you've at least got to make the phone call. You know, leave the president a note. Tell him I called. I understand he's engaged. What can I do to help?
Right.
You know, what can I do to help? Because I don't want 6 months later him making a remark about my escalator doesn't work and it reflects exactly my attitude of not giving a crap, right?
Right.
At least call and say, what can I do to help? So back to the investigation. You do have to conduct the investigation, but you don't have to make a big deal out of it publicly.
Right.
Someone's got to make the phone call, though. Someone's got to call chief of security at the UN building through Secret Service. Secret Service had responsibility for the overall security of the General Assembly. Someone's got to make the phone call that says, you find out what happened to that escalator.
Right.
And make sure it never happens again. Right. And that has to be done, but I wouldn't do it in public for a variety of reasons, not the least of which is you don't know what the answer is going to be when it comes back. Because
right.
Because the UN is saying it was the president's photographer that set off a sensor.
Okay.
Well, let's suppose that's true. Let's suppose that's true. What does that mean? Is it really the White House's fault? Is it really the photographer's fault? Really? Because you expected the president to come without a photographer. Is that what you're saying? You're saying that you have an escalator that can accidentally freeze in place because a photographer bumps into it? Is that's your defense? Because that doesn't sound like a very good defense of a criticism of your security protocol. That sounds to me like an admission that you screwed up.
I don't disagree with you, Mike, but I'll give you a slightly different perspective, which is I blame the Secret Service more, because just watching that, like, look, when that person took that shot at President Trump on the campaign trail,
yep,
I think we talked about it. One of the things that shocked me was the lack of reaction and how I thought the Secret Service would react, right? They allowed him to get up before the area was secure. You know, they let him pose and do his fist pump, which became iconic. But if there was a second shooter out there, you know, you're just presenting another target.
Or if the first one weren't dead.
Or if the first one weren't dead, right? So I correctly, and I think our friend Larry Sharp did a whole show with me on this. It's like, okay, that kind of means to me that the Secret Service is in the bag against Trump, you know, to give him credit about what he was saying, right? So maybe yes, maybe no, but it was definitely a bad look. And the head of the Secret Service did herself no favors when she tried to explain what happened, right?
Right.
I kind of saw the same thing again. For example, why is there nobody in front of the president on the escalator? Like, if someone were to stand at the top of, and you're right, we don't have that view, but why isn't someone in front? The second that thing stopped, why wasn't there a circle of agents around the president and the first lady?
Coming down the escalator.
Coming down
from behind him.
And from the side, right? Like, I mean, he should have just been enveloped like those old Praetorian guards.
Absolutely.
You know? So that, to me, is a failure, even if it was an innocent malfunction. To your point, maybe somebody set off a sensor, who knows, right? Maybe something got caught in the treads, whatever. But I was more surprised by the lack of seriousness and the lack of organization showed by the Secret Service. Now, this time around, it would be on the Republicans. It would be on the Trump people, quote unquote, because Republicans control everything. It's very clear who controls the White House and by how much of an iron fist there is. So my question would be, what is the reason for this lack of urgency or proper response by the Secret Service in that situation?
My theory is that it's a lack of creativity. And that lack of creativity in the minds of the Secret Service agents involved manifests in something that looks like an absence of urgency. Let me give you two examples that counter each other, that each one surprised me when I saw it. One was some years ago, I don't remember, someone can look it up. The guy that climbs over the fence at the back of the White House, runs across the lawn, lets himself in the back door that's unlocked.
Right.
Runs past the lone guard who's sitting by the door, by the unlocked door, runs down the hallway and makes it halfway to the Oval Office.
Right.
Now, I appreciate that the Secret Service has to think of so many things. I'm pretty sure if I had asked a 10-year-old, how are you gonna get to the president? I think, you know, she's going to say, well, you know, I guess I got to climb the fence and then I got to run through that door and then I got to run down the hallway.
Yeah.
Did you not think that, I mean,
lock the door?
Can you lock the door? Do me a solid. Maybe you'll put a little chain on or maybe the deadbolt. I don't know.
Right.
Maybe have the Marine on the outside so he can see someone coming. Maybe have four Marines in case, you know, when one's blowing his nose and one's sneezing and one's on his phone, at least there's one looking, right?
Right.
Can you get the basics? I think we all thought that there was, you know, cannons were going to come out of the lawn and dogs were going to start running.
Right.
And a sniper on the roof and all these systems that you wouldn't make it 8 feet past the fence. And that's just not the case. And I think it was just a lack of imagination. You know, we always talk about the gaming the system, right? You pay a hacker to hack into your website. You know, you got to be paying, you know, two high school kids. You know, how would you break into the White House if you had to do it? So I thought that was a weird example, to your point. The other one is on the other side of the coin. And this will once again demonstrate that some of our audience needs to talk to their parents about stories that we bring up. George Herbert Walker Bush was once at a state dinner in Japan. He has the flu. He is sick. And he decides to go to the dinner anyway because, you know, you gotta take one for the team. You got to play hurt, right?
Right.
Okay. And he's no spring chicken at this point, but he figures he's good enough to go. Okay, they go. Now, as you and I know, Japanese food is terrific, but can be a little bit different than what you're used to if you grow up in Texas and Connecticut. Okay.
Kids, so, this is a 30-year-old story, but it's a good one. Go ahead.
He blows chow.
Yes.
Now, he feels it coming.
Right.
So he decides, I'm president of the United States, I don't want to blow chow on the table.
Right.
So I turn, I think it was to his left. Yeah. He turns and blows Cho, I'm the prime minister of Japan. Okay. Now,
let's face it, Flounder, you didn't throw up in front of Dean Wormer. You threw up on Dean Wormer.
Yes. Right. Exactly. And it's double secret probation for you.
Right.
And, you know, this is probably not his finest moment. He did manage to make fun of himself the next day. Good for him. But it's a very tense moment. It's a very bad thing. Now, when this happens, Secret Service doesn't know. Boss has the flu. He's blowing chow. You know, Oyster went the wrong way. He's going to be fine. The Secret Service agent jumps up on the dining room table in front of all of the dignitaries, walks across the table. Mind if I step on your filet?
Right.
To get to the president, loosen the collar, make sure, you know, are we doing CPR here? Is there something stuck? Did someone just shoot my boss? You know, what's going down? And there was a moment when you might have thought that was an overreaction. But if you've only got one job. Your job is to keep the president of the United States alive, right? Your job is not to worry about the filet under your sole.
Or the optics.
You're not worried about the optics, right? The only way you get in trouble is if the old man croaks and you are 18 feet away.
Right.
And so it brought this sense of urgency that didn't require a lot of creativity. It was just reacting because the priority is, I don't care about anything but making sure that guy's going to be okay. And we learned a lot from that moment about what a crappy job they have, but we learned something about their attitude as well. And I think you and I wish that we had seen that on the escalator.
I agree. And since you mentioned the first President Bush, his son, I'm reminded of giving a press conference somewhere in the Middle East along with the local dignitary. And one of the local reporters ended up throwing a size 11 at President Bush.
Absolutely.
And what was shoe? He threw his shoe at him, yeah.
And the president dodged it. I thought he was pretty good. He was like, whoa.
Twice. He was pretty spry. They got off two shoes at him before the Secret Service agent jumped in.
Second shoer.
So part of what back then I said to myself was, my goodness, and he's supposed to be protected by these people if someone pulled a weapon, a real weapon at him. How long did it take for that secret? Now, maybe they were laughing. Maybe they said it's just a shoe, but that's not an excuse. Like, why wasn't somebody between the president and the guy who hurled his shoe?
Who fights with a shoe?
Right, and that's the thing, right? So that's why now, to give appropriate credit where it's due, I could see where the conspiracy theorists are lining up, first with the assassination attempt in Butler, and then with the malfunction that happened at the UN. And it's not a matter of leftist, right, extremist violence. It's just protocol to me. If your job, like you said, your one job is to keep this guy alive no matter what.
Come honestly, pure high water.
Right. Human shield around him. Somebody should have been around. Several people should have been around him. At the very least, one guy should have been shielding him literally by draping himself. And to be cold about it without any care for Melania. Their first job is President Trump. And then the first lady. So that's what I found disappointing. Not necessarily the malfunctioning or purposely pranked escalator, but just the Secret Service response. Mike, do you think there's going to be any blowback on the Secret Service for that lack of response?
I think that there might be a little bit. I think some will depend on what we learn about the stupid escalator. So I think the jury is out. I don't like to comment in too much detail on specific cases because, as we always say, a new fact comes out and makes everyone feel stupid.
Right.
But I think there is a potential there. There is absolutely a potential there because we all saw it.
Yeah. All right, Mike, it looks like we've come to the end of our time.
You didn't like my second shoer comment.
I did. I chuckled. Second yeah, sure.
Not a big chuckle. I worked so hard at entertaining you, John.
I promise it will be in the promo. We'll put the second sure comment in the promo.
I'm not sure it's worth all that. Okay.
All right, everyone. Thank you for joining us once again here on Liberty Lens. We're here every week. Catch us every Thursday right here at grumblingsmedia.com, at grumblingsmedia on all the social media platforms. Join us every week for great content on one Liberty issue every week. Until next time, this has been Big John alongside my friend and co-host, Mr. Mike Dermott. We'll catch you again next week. Peace, everyone.